The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, Russia's economy is severely struggling. That's according to Moscow's former finance minister, Andrei Nechayev. The sanctions on the Kremlin are beginning to be felt in Russian society, said he. Certain items hard to come by. But are the measures really effective? And are Russian allies like China buffering the serious impacts of the sanctions? I'm joined now by Assistant Professor of Political Science at Trinity College in Dublin, Noah Buckley. Noah, good morning.
Good morning.
So, the sanctions, everyone thought they would bring the Russian economy to its knees reasonably rapidly, although at the same time we were still buying oil and gas from them. It didn't happen. What's happening now?
It hasn't happened. It's been more of a steady, slow drip, I think, in degrading the Russian military's ability to, you know, build new missiles, wage war in an effective way, and, you know, start to put a bit of pressure on the elites around Putin. But I think the idea that it's going to lead to the collapse of the Russian economy, unfortunately, maybe is just not in the cards.
What parts of the economy are suffering?
Car manufacturing, high technology, all the sort of computer components that they're trying to build, and other aspects of manufacturing where they're facing competition from China and other exporters.
Now, Russia will keep going because they've got the resources. They're selling their oil and gas still in parts of the world. But I don't know what the economic structure of the oil and gas industry is, but could they be actually producing at a loss?
They might be producing at a loss as far as tax revenue. Certainly, the government is not taking in nearly as much revenue from oil and gas as they were before the war. There's still a market for this these petrochemicals and other products. Yeah.
And they're selling them, obviously, at cut price to those willing customers. And they're probably, if not happy about what's happening to people in the war in Ukraine, happy with the economic fallout from it.
That's right. I mean, it's too good a deal to pass up for so many countries around the world that are trying to develop, trying to, you know, grow their own economies. Yeah.
Now, more sanctions have been applied. The diamond market is the latest thing to which sanctions have been applied. I mean, their banks have been sanctioned. Much of their industrial output, their oil and gas, is not being bought in Western Europe. I don't know what impact the diamond business will have on the economy.
Yeah, I think it'll have a small impact. I mean, this is not a large, you know, proportion of what Russia exports or produces. But the idea, I think, is to just start to squeeze a little bit more and get these elites nervous and start to really decrease the tax revenue that the government really needs to, you know, wage this very expensive war.
How much of the economy is dedicated to that war? Do we know?
We don't know. They've made.
I mean, if you have a budget of so many billions, how many of those billions, what fraction of those billions goes to the war as distinct from making people live better?
A very large proportion. The portion of the national budget that is now secret, and they just don't say what's in that proportion, is now about a third, which has grown really rapidly. So they're spending huge amounts of money, both trying to wage this war and try to keep people at least minimally happy so that they don't, you know, get too disgruntled.
Now, we know that America is debating its debt ceiling at the moment, and Kevin McCarthy having these meetings with Joe Biden to move the deadline at least, which is, I think, June the 1st, which is only days away. So America owes huge amounts of money. I heard this morning that the UK owes £2 trillion, and we ourselves are in debt to the tune of 220 million euros. So it's normal for states to be in debt. Has Russia been running on current account? Has it been able to pay its own way because of the oil and gas revenues? And is it likely to have to borrow?
So it is starting to have to borrow. The budget deficits are enormous and growing, I think much more rapidly than they themselves anticipated. So they've started to borrow, but they do have some money socked away from, you know, previous years of saving up. And it will start to be a problem, though, because they don't have access to the capital markets around the world that many other countries would.
So who are they going to borrow from? The Chinese?
Partly from themselves and partly from the Chinese. Force businesses.
You mean to say that those people, the oligarchs and so on, have got loads and loads of money. that Putin will dip into their pockets.
They're extracting huge amounts of money from businesses and oligarchs and just saying you have to pay a one-time tax, you know, an extra sort of for the good of the nation, right?
Sounds like the USC here, which was a temporary little arrangement which became permanent. What impact is that likely to have? I mean, is Putin so feared that they just do what they're told, or are there people who will now raise their voices?
I think there's a lot of discontent. People are not very happy with how things are going within the elites and these oligarchs. But Putin is the only game in town, and there's just no alternative. And the risk to speaking up or, you know, supporting someone else is just too great.
I mean, it is a totalitarian state now.
It's certainly approaching that, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the question is, what's more to squeeze? Diamond's the latest squeeze. What is left? What have they not done?
It's really hard to say. There are a lot of metals that Russia produces, but many of these are really needed in the West, right? And we need to, consume some of these for our batteries and so on. So it's hard to say. You could maybe gold or some other, you know, products and keep closing loopholes. But I think the big ones are already out there.
Now, the whole geopolitical map, they're trying to change it. I mean, they want to be closer to the Chinese and other people in that general region because they don't want the West to be the dominant force anymore. How likely is that to evolve and quickly evolve?
I think China is taking it pretty slow, and Russia would probably like to speed it up. Right now, Russia's prime minister is in China for meetings, trying to develop this relationship. But China is very happy to sit back and just, you know, take advantage of the situation. And make sure that they don't lose that leverage.
Yeah. So is Russia at the end of all of this likely to be completely enthralled to China?
In part, I think so, although maybe China doesn't want to bear the responsibility of you know, for the well-being of Russia, or take responsibility if Russia then, you know, collapses or changes regime at some point. So it's a fine balance.
Yeah. So what will happen? I mean, Putin won't live forever, but he could live for many years. How long might this war continue? How long can they afford to continue? And, you know, is he simply waiting for Trump to return to the White House so that the support for Ukraine is stopped or stalled?
It really seems like the war could continue for a long time. And certainly Putin is sending out signals within his circles that it could last a long time. And maybe, you know, in 3, 4, 5 years, the Russian economy is really going to be ground into the ground so much that things might start to get shaky. But a long way off.
Now, in the United States, you can go back, you can look for parallels. The Vietnam War is probably the best parallel, except that Vietnam was very far from the United States of America, very much a foreign country. Ukraine has a different relationship with Russia. It's a neighbor, and there are those who believe it's part of the motherland. So the disenchantment of Americans with the Vietnam War, the unwillingness to be drafted, really led to the crisis, the domestic crisis that led to the departure of Lyndon Baines Johnson. He didn't run for election again. The war was ended, probably ignominiously. That's not going to happen with Ukraine, or could it?
It doesn't seem like it. For now, a lot of the Russian population is either just disengaged from the war. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to know about it. Presumably, it's for the good of the nation because Putin knows best. And others are still on board, right? They're fighting a good fight. They're fighting against what they would think of as a Nazi regime, right? So it's still something that people are really either behind or just disengaged from. And we don't see the sort of movement like we did in the U.S. around Vietnam.
So in summary, no instant collapse of the Russian economy, but perhaps a slow draining of its energy and resource.
I'm afraid not. Yes, I think the only thing that would really lead to a collapse is a collapse of the oil price, the global oil price, which just seems very unlikely.
And they're trying to manipulate that because they're OPEC plus one, and that one is Russia. So they're trying to manipulate, you know, creating scarcity so the price remains high.
Yeah, short of, a global depression, it just seems unlikely that anyone's going to allow the price of oil to drop so far.
Noah Buckley, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Trinity College in Dublin. Noah, thank you very much for joining us. Now, as you may know, May is Skin Cancer Awareness Month. Skin cancer is the most common cancer in Ireland, with over 13,000 new cases diagnosed every year. And the National Cancer Registry of Ireland expects this number to double by 2040. Now, early detection is vital. If spotted early, up to 90% of cases are totally curable. To tell us more, I'm joined by Peter Maher, Consultant Plastic Reconstructive and Aesthetic Surgeon at the Beacon Hospital. Peter, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, most common in Ireland, and there are categories of skin cancer. Explain.
Yeah, it's the there's a very significant prevalence of skin cancer in Ireland. It accounts for almost 30% of the entire cancer diagnosis in the country. So it's by far and away the greater cancer group to deal with. Skin cancer itself is divided between two separate groups. There's what are known as non-melanoma skin cancers and melanoma skin cancers, and they are fundamentally different from in biological terms, and most importantly in terms of how they behave. The far larger group is the non-melanoma skin cancers, which, rounding off percentages, account for about 25% of all skin cancer annually, and the remaining 5% is made up of the more serious and more challenging from a management point of view, the group of melanomas, of which there are numerous different types.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about the non-melanoma types first. And how would people know they have one of these things? What do they look like?
Look, I think we, human nature is such that we tend to discharge responsibility for looking after ourselves to medical professionals. But in this regard, frequently problems with our skin and moles can be identified by the patient themselves or by ourselves. And we have a simple algorithm for looking at moles. It's referred to as the A, B, C, D or E. And so we are a moley nation, we're a fair-skinned nation, and there's very few true Irish people who don't have a mole somewhere. So if we start with A, that refers to the symmetry of the mole or the shape of the mole. If it's a well-circumscribed or round mole and uniform, we tend not to worry about them. But if they're slightly asymmetrical, one half the mole being slightly different shape from the other, we get a little bit concerned. The border is the B. And we refer to a uniform border where it's a circular mole, the edge of it isn't of any concern, it's not fragmented or anything. And if the edge is not well circumscribed or defined, we get a little bit concerned. The C then refers to the colour, and this is often the easiest thing to notice when you're looking at your moles. A change in colour is significant. It might darken, or the dark pigment within it might become fragmented. So one half the mole might be slightly lighter or darker. The D then refers to diameter. And again, this is a little subtle, but if you have a mole that's greater, we say about 6 millimetres, so probably the head of a pencil. If it's larger than that, we would have some concern, or that changes is most important. Then lastly, it's a little bit more subtle because these moles, we carry them around with us, so we tend not to notice them change, but our partners, our family might notice a mole change, and that refers to the evolution, or the E, the A, B, C, D, E, the evolution of the mole. If the mole changes in any way, you really need to seek help or get an opinion from somebody.
Now, people sometimes are very moley. They have, you know, literally hundreds of moles of greater or smaller size. What do you think of mole mapping?
Yeah, it's there's a vogue for it currently, and I think it's a good thing. But it's like anything, we in terms of the risks of what group of people are exposed to risk. One of the risk groups are people who have greater than 50 moles. This is something that makes general practitioners and physicians in general cause them some concern. And mole mapping is, when it's done properly, by properly qualified people, particularly, in my opinion, mole mapping should really be the remit of dermatologists, where they have access to the right equipment. And mole mapping essentially looks at a mole, takes a photograph, a high quality digital photograph of it, and then perhaps a year later you might see the same person again, and they use the same equipment to take a picture of the same mole.
I have this vision that, you know, they put your naked body on the slab, they scan you. It draws this map of all your moles. They turn you over, you do the B side, and then you've got a map that you can literally place on next year's map and see, is there any change?
No, it's not quite that terrifying. No, there's no there's no A and B side, unfortunately. But what would normally happen, and I think coming back to the concept, it's about the change in a mole, and that's where the mapping comes into it. In isolation, in a moment in time, it's sometimes difficult to identify mole to change, and that's troublesome. But if it changes, it's significant. So the key here really is that the quality of the images are good, and they are looked at by the same person. And ideally, as I said previously, that's somebody who's qualified to look at moles.
Now, the moles, is that where you find the melanomas? Or, I mean, there are the other kinds of cancers that you say are much easier to treat, the basal cell carcinomas and the squamous cell carcinomas?
Yeah, squamous, A-M-O-U-S, squamous cell carcinomas. So 25% of the skin cancers we're talking about are non-melanoma skin cancers. So they are eminently treatable. And a lot of your listeners will be frightened when they hear they have a diagnosis of skin cancer, but these conditions are treatable and curable. And
I mean, they can treat them very quickly with liquid nitrogen, for example. Just pop them off.
It's certainly one way. I mean, there's a number of different ways of treating non-melanoma skin cancers, and liquid nitrogen or topical therapies, as we now refer to these modalities as, are very effective. And other ways of treating them would include surgical excision, of course, and more often than not, we would do what's called an excision biopsy. Take a little bit of the mole away, find out what it is, and then if topical therapy is an option, we might go down that road. And we would normally share the care. There's a lot of overlap between a consultant dermatologist and consultant plastic and reconstructive surgeon, and we share the workload in that regard.
Yeah, you might have to nip it out, for example.
Yeah, so you'd normally take a little bit away, and then depending on whether the two large groups, and a lot of your listeners will have heard these terms, the two large groups are referred to as basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas.
And what are the squamous?
They are a different variety. They involve the squamous layer of the skin, whereas the basal cell carcinomas involve the basal layer of the skin. The squamous cell carcinomas can be slightly more aggressive, but again, they are both entirely treatable. And the key, as with most cancers, is prevention if we can, so prevent the causative factors, and then early access to treatment. And therein is one of the bigger challenges currently.
Now, the question of secondaries forming from a cancer, is it only the melanomas that will create secondaries?
Certainly secondary deposits or metastatic deposits from melanoma is a real problem. You can get metastatic deposits from squamous cell carcinoma. It's not common. It typically occurs when the squamous cell carcinomas are in what are deemed to be high-risk areas, broadly speaking, the face and the hands. But it is thankfully very uncommon to get metastatic metastatic disease with squamous cell carcinoma.
With the melanomas, is it fair to say that some people are diagnosed when a secondary is discovered? And then they say, uh-oh, where did this all begin? It was a melanoma.
Yeah, look, that certainly happens where you get somebody who presents with a secondary. Thankfully, Pat, it's rare. Under normal circumstances, we would see a melanoma in the first instance and then look out for the secondary. But again, we're in an unusual situation with skin cancer because it can be prevented. So if you look at any other kind of skin cancer, we look at how do you address it? Well, the first way is to prevent it. There are many skin cancers we don't know the cause of. We know that sun exposure, for example, is a very significant factor with the genesis both of non-melanoma and melanoma skin cancer. So, you know, taking adequate precautions to prevent that happening is very important. And then if you are in the situation that it happens, you need early access to treatment. And that's a huge problem. Many of your listeners will tell the story where they've been referred to a dermatologist and they haven't got an appointment for 18 months or even 2 years, regardless of what sector of the healthcare system they are in. And that's a problem that we need to address. And certainly it's one of the problems that in the Beacon Hospital where I work, we're currently trying to address, where we can give patients rapid access to being seen
now,
by experts.
There are those who'll say, you know, smoke one cigarette and you might get lung cancer. You know, statistically, of course, it's possible. But what about sunlight and the amount of it you get and in what doses you get? I mean, some people literally burn their bodies when they go out in the sun. Other people might tan easily, for example, and spend the whole day in the sun.
Sure. I mean, look, at this part of the world, on this seaboard of Europe, we are fair-skinned. I mean, of course, there are some Irish people with a little bit of Spanish blood who tan easily, but the majority of us are...
Would you not be a bit that way now? Just look looking at you seem to be more sallow than
I'm not sure that I'm not sure of any Spanish blood, and I can't vouch for yourself. But look, I think if you've fair skin, you need to protect it. You need to be sensible. Sunlight is good for you. I mean, patients often say to me, you know, should I stay out of the sun completely? No, you shouldn't. It's normal sunlight is very good for us. You should stay away from a sunbed. Absolutely, they should, in my opinion, be banned. But you should. A bit of sunlight is good, but you need to be sensible. And it's not just a question of, you know, the overcast day. There's as many harmful rays of sunshine or sunlight out there.
Even though you don't get burnt on that.
Absolutely. So we need to be very vigilant. For the next generation, I think it's going to be completely different. And you've even seen it in the last 10 years with rashy vests and sun creams and so on and so forth for the children.
This is a question. If you've been referred to a dermatologist by a GP and the wait is months and months, but you're very concerned about the mole in question, what do you do? Do you go to A&E?
Look, you know, I touched on this earlier. This is a huge problem, and it's interesting that one of your listeners has brought it up. The current wait to see either a dermatologist or indeed a plastic surgeon is of the order of 18 months. I don't think the answer is to attend A&E. I mean, we've enough problems with our colleagues in the A&E department dealing with everything else. I think we need to revisit the subject. It's certainly, as I said to you already, you know, in the Beacon we have what we refer to as a see and treat clinic. So patients come and see us, are seen by somebody senior, and they're treated the same day. And that's really the ideal model that we need to try and generate in all sectors, both private and public sectors.
But I'm sure you have your waiting lists too.
Yes, we do. But we've ways of dealing with it. You know, it's like anything. If you have a waiting list and there's loads of people waiting to see you, well, then you get more people who can help them. So you expand your department.
But is the idea that you kind of triage and you say, well, okay, this person, that looks a bit dodgy. We better do something about that. But on the other hand, your condition, it doesn't look like it's something that needs attention today. Come back to us in a month.
This is the real risk, isn't it? Triage is fine if you're triaging a person in real time and they're in front of you. But if you're triaging somebody who's got a mole or sent in a poor quality mole, and sometimes we do get images sent in, and sometimes they're very, very helpful. You know, the GP will send in a very helpful image of a mole and you say, look, this can't wait. But there are patients who fall foul of the system who don't access the services, unfortunately, for various different reasons, depending on what sector of the healthcare system they're in occasionally.
We've talked about moles, but there are other things. I'm reading a list of symptoms here. You know, a flat red spot, a firm red lump, a lump or a spot that's tender to touch, an ulcer that won't heal, a lump with a scaly or horny top, rough scaly patches.
I'm very impressed, Pat. You've obviously been reading the textbooks last night before you came into work today. They are all descriptions of various different types of non-melanoma skin cancers. The horny the lesion with a keratotic horn or a crusty lesion or a little red, scaly, what looks like a little bit of perhaps psoriasis or a rash on your skin. These are all the hallmarks of non-melanoma skin cancers. Extremely common, extremely easy to treat and cure.
Well, that's the good news.
Absolutely. Right.
So it is Skin Cancer Awareness Month, and your advice to people is just check out your moles.
Yeah, just remember what I said, A, B, C, D, or E. And if you have any concerns, you know, check in with your GP. And if they are genuinely concerned, they can hopefully expedite an opinion with an expert dermatologist or a plastic surgeon.
And of course, sunscreen. But a question which I don't know whether you can answer it. How can you convince your children to put on sunscreen, and what sprays would be recommended?
Well, of course, the suggestion there is that the children no longer listen to what we tell them. So times have changed a little bit. I think the best way to educate children is just to be straight up with them and tell them this is what happens if you don't do something. And I think the younger children, in real term, will be wearing rashes. If you go to Australia, I lived in Australia for a time, and in Australia, the children have to wear rash vests. And if you're on the beach and you fall asleep, the police wake you up. This is the kind of sunbeds are banned. They're illegal in Australia. So, you know, these are the kind of precautions that we need to take. So just be vigilant and tell the children that this is serious. You need to look after yourselves. We can't be there all the time for you.
Peter Maher, Consultant Plastic, Reconstructive and Aesthetic Surgeon at the Beacon Hospital. Peter, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.